Hello, and welcome to the Nutrition and Life Podcast. This is where we look at various nutrition and fitness-related topics through the lens of application. We want to give you practical takeaways so that you can create your healthiest, best self backed by knowledge. Now, onto the episode with your host, Coach Lisa.
Hello, and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life Podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with functional nutrition coach, Dane Anderson. He is a coach for Maximum Performance Health and an amazing transformation coach in general. If you go and check out his Instagram, his stories, and just in general, his posts are full of amazing proof of his work. So I'm very, very excited to talk to you today. Dane, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lisa. Excited to be here. I'm very blessed that you brought me on and excited to chat back and forth about some interesting and exciting topics.
Oh yeah, we're definitely going to quote unquote bust some myths, or just in general, maybe some people are going to have some of their beliefs crushed or busted. But before we get into that, maybe you want to give us a little bit of a background about yourself, like how you got to where you are today, how you even came interested in quote unquote functional nutrition, et cetera.
Yeah, certainly. So as Lisa stated, my name is Dane Anderson. I am about to turn 28 years old. I live here in Logan, Utah, which is a town of about 40,000 people, hour and a half north of Salt Lake City. For any of you that have visited it, it's a gem. Mm-hmm. My background kind of started, my mother was a dietitian. She was one of the head professors at Utah State University here in Logan, Utah. And so I grew up with a pretty decent understanding of nutrition. And as you know, life went on, I ended up going to Utah State. I actually studied psychology and business. So minor in business, psychology is my major. And so, you know, it is interesting how much of this ties into the psychology side of things. You know, being a functional health coach, there's a psychological component that we'll get into as well. But, you know, my education in the nutritional field really came after the fact. I mean, throughout my college years, I was still involved with bodybuilding. And so I had years of personal experience, personal trials, and then obviously helping friends. But that also comes just from the bodybuilding side of things, which typically isn't your healthiest route to go. And we'll also dive into some of that, I'm sure. But as things progressed, you know, I've got probably 10 different certifications through different, you know, institutions. And the biggest, I would say my most incredible one would be through Metabolic Mentor University, who they have a very in-depth functional course. Took me about a year and a half to complete, you know, lots of thousands of dollars spent. I mean, you talk about my college degree versus my continuing education. I'm about 10 times the money in continuing education than what I was in my college degree. But I also study under Vince Pitstick and Alan Kress, who are incredible functional practitioners. And then I also study under a gentleman named Phil Viz, who is an incredible bodybuilding mentor, because I'm kind of breeding the two together, which you don't see a lot. So I take a lot of the bro science, but a lot of the functional tools, and bring them together to create a healthier environment for the people that want to compete as well. So that's kind of my background. I kind of fell in love with it just through the love of sports and weightlifting, you know, through however you want to call it, you know, breakups, injuries, and then kind of fueling the fire. And then it was just kind of becomes your passion, and one thing leads to another. And I'm a firm believer that everything leads you down the path you're supposed to go on. And so I ended up falling in love with the process just through life experiences.
Amazing. Thank you for giving us a bit of a background. And I can only agree with your belief there, in the sense of everything sort of happens for a reason, or the universe puts certain things in our path. So I love it. And I actually just completed my level one for MNU, I went to the Hybrid Health Summit earlier this year. I don't know if you were there too. Maybe we actually even met even unknowingly. But yeah, I was there because Vince was on this podcast in late last year, and he invited me to come to the summit as well. And it was an incredible experience. And like you say, I feel like I've only just scratched the surface of that whole space. But yeah, it was a lovely community. Were you there in January?
Yeah. So me and the whole Maximum Performance Health team was there. I'm sad that I didn't get a chance to actually meet you in person. Small world.
It is a small world for sure, but I will most certainly be going to the next one whenever that is. So I'm looking forward to meeting you then.
Yeah, I look forward to it as well.
But yeah, I really want to talk about some of these topics that we often connect with, the term functional nutrition, or even just when I opened up my first lecture of what is the FLUSH, one of the systems that that MMU teaches you. It talked about fasting or the fast, and I was like, fasting good or bad, or is that actually harmful? I personally have tried intermittent fasting when it first became a bit of a hype. And I just thought, oh, maybe I should give this a go. Everyone is saying it's so great for cell autophagy. I personally then found it was very challenging for me because I already led such a high stress life. And so at some point in the morning, I started getting shaky. I couldn't focus anymore. But I was trying to fit myself into that box. I need to fast until like 11 a.m. or whatever it is. I can't eat 10 minutes earlier. Silly. Nowadays, I personally have found a much better method for myself. But yeah, tell us, what is the deal with fasting? Is it helpful? Is it harmful? And especially for women, as we tend to be a little bit more sensitive to those kind of things.
Yeah, you know, so there's a lot of, it's not black and white, like most things in the fitness world. And I think that's where people get confused, is because you get on Instagram and you see, oh, I should be fasting, but oh, I need to eat breakfast. And so there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusing information. And so I'm going to start off by saying it's very individualized. Now, granted, I am a big believer in fasting with the right situation. So fasting, right? When we talk about autophagy, well, what does autophagy mean? Autophagy is essentially your body going into an energy system to basically feast on old senescent cells, which are basically disease cells that are kind of, you know, filled with inflammation. They've kind of changed shape. They're not functioning super well. They might deal with, you know, insulin resistance, hormone resistance, and your body basically comes in and feasts on the bad parts of the cells, uses them as energy, and then replaces with a new stem cell that functions quite a bit better. And so the whole concept of autophagy makes sense, right? You fast, you limit your food intake, and your body will feast on these bad cells that are no longer serving us, right? And so the way that I look at it is, when it comes to fasting, we've got to be in an environment that supports fasting. So let's talk about a high functioning businesswoman like yourself. You say, okay, well, I've never fasted in my life, but I see this research and I want to try it. And the first time you go into it, you feel awful. Okay, well, why do you feel awful? Well, fasting is no different than any other stimulus on this earth that you're trying to create an adaptation in the body. If I want to be a marathon runner, if I go out and I try to run a marathon day one, I'm going to feel like shit regardless. Yeah, could I muster through it with my mind? Probably, but I'm not going to feel good during the process. It's no different than someone saying, all right, I'm diving into a 4-day fast with no preparation. Your body's not accustomed to that, right? Especially someone like you, Lisa, where you are high functioning, you are more of a mesomorph type female that has higher muscle mass. You know, you probably build muscle pretty well and you keep it relatively lean kind of year round. But you also probably sit with a little bit higher blood sugars because your body wants to protect your muscle mass. And I see this a lot in females in your same situation. And so You know, we have two different energy pathways that I like to talk about. One that's called mTOR and one that's called AMPK, right? And think of mTOR. Most people run off of mTOR. This is more of a sugar burning state where we see mTOR is usually activated from higher levels of protein, right? High levels of the amino acid leucine, a caloric surplus typically. And when we're inducing a hypertrophy stimulus on the body, and mTOR is usually going to signal growth in the body, not necessarily just muscle growth, but it's going to signal growth as a whole, right? Whereas AMPK, this stimulus runs more off of caloric deficit, reduction in protein intake. This system usually would turn on during sleeping. And this AMPK induces more of that autophagy, that cell turnover. One of the best ways to get into the AMPK is also the ketogenic diet, as well as carnivore diet, if done properly. And so when we have these two different energy pathways, right, let's say for your entire life, you've been eating high protein, you've been hitting the weights hard, whether that's CrossFit, whether that's hypertrophy training, you're running on endorphins, high stress situations, lots of cortisol is being released. Well, your body gets in this state of constantly burning blood sugars as an energy source. And so we typically see blood sugars high, but ketones stay pretty darn low. And so it puts your body in a position where your body likes to run off of that. It's comfortable with that because you've created that adaptation of running off of blood sugars. And let's say, for example, I'm going to steer this just a little bit. Let's say I have a middle-aged female that has always lived a healthy life, consumed high amounts of protein, and she gets to that kind of sticking point in her life where she's like, man, I just can't lose fat. So the typical narrative there is more exercise, and then I'm going to cut my carbs out, right? And so when we do that, your body is going to still, if you do it properly and you don't abuse your body should be able to kick over into this AMPK. But when you keep stress too high, your exercise is too overloaded, and then you keep protein high, cut carbs, and your calories really reduce, your body is going to likely stay in that mTOR response by essentially breaking down your protein intake, converting it over to blood sugars through a process called gluconeogenesis, and keeping your blood sugars high. So now we create this adaptation that your body says, all right, well, carbs aren't present, but I need those blood sugars to fuel the high intense stimulus or the high stress environment I'm in. So the easier route is to break down protein or muscle tissue, convert it and keep blood sugars high to keep you fueled off that system. Does that make sense?
That makes 100% sense. Yes, absolutely.
Right. And so we wire this adaptation to be stuck in this sugar burning state. And if your body can't flip over to this AMPK stimulus and burn ketones as a fuel source, you're never going to turn over the cells the way you need to. And so you're going to create an environment of major inflammation within the body, and then systems start to shut down, right? And so full circle with this, when it comes to fasting, I think fasting is absolutely crucial to pulse in certain times of your life. But like you said, we're not going to just dive into it. We're going to walk you into it. So we might start off by flipping you into more of a keto-based diet, keeping protein a little bit higher, right? And then slowly starting to notch your protein down, get your body starting to produce a little bit of ketones, starting to understand, okay, well, this is a different energy source, and I'm going to figure out how to use it because it's what's available, right? And during this time, we can certainly use tools like exogenous ketones to help your body understand the process of ketones for a fuel source. And so we'll slowly walk you into ketosis to get your ketones running, and then we might start to shorten your eating window. So if you've been eating 12 hours a day, well, then maybe we're going to go to 10 hours a day for 4 or 5 days. Then we might move to 8 hours a day. Then we may do 1 day of 6 hour eating window. And then we're going to pull back out and go back to 12 hours and give your body kind of a reset. So I'm a firm believer that fasting is the key to longevity because you can turn over those cells. But with a female that's very high performing, the issue we run into is if you're not adapted to that fasting, you're going to end up burning through that muscle tissue at a much quicker rate. You're going to feel like garbage throughout the process. And then you're going to end up being in a position where you develop that skinny fat physique because you burn through your muscle tissue and your body doesn't know how to use fats as a fuel source. And there are other complications that come with it as well.
No, that makes absolute sense. You explained that very, very well, Dane, with regards to mTOR and AMPK, both of those pathways. And particularly with mTOR, as you mentioned, it's the growth pathway, right? And if we think of any harmful cell or inflammation or even cancer cell, then I think that's why mTOR, while you don't want to stimulate mTOR too often or too much, is kind of been a message out there as well, because it might increase risk of cancer, etc. So sort of a little bit playing into what you're saying, and I think you just explained it very, very eloquently. But you also, what I liked the most was that you said we're going to do that progressively. And I think a lot of people already struggle having just a 12-hour eating window. Like, honestly, often I started working with people and they have their first meal like right after they get up, maybe 5 or 6 a.m. And then they, of course, keep snacking at night when they're sitting on their couch and don't finish eating until like 10 p.m. And so we're, yeah, absolutely on the same plan here when we're saying, hey, let's just start with where we're at and building on that. I really like how you gave us examples there. And you also mentioned carbs, and that's actually one of the things I also wanted to talk to you about. So you mentioned some of the carbs potentially more in that kind of scenario, switching that more for fats. And in general, though, it sounded like there is an importance to carbs. So particularly to those high stress females, or sometimes when we see someone who has always had high protein and now they want to lose fat, and so they reduce their overall calories, they pull from carbs. But why is that sometimes a mistake?
Right. Yeah. So I want to first touch on just kind of with that mTOR and AMPK. We want to look at metabolic flexibility. You know, I said fasting is the key to longevity. I'm going to rephrase that. Metabolic flexibility is the key to longevity. And what I mean by that is your body, think of these two energy pathways as almost a lever, and your body can flip forward, burn carbs, burn, you know, blood sugars as a fuel source, and then kick back and burn fats as a fuel source. Our bodies are designed to be able to use both energy systems very effectively. So the problem with us going into a no-carb diet, right? So what happens when we eat carbs? So let's say that I take carbohydrates and I ingest carbs. My body's going to digest that pretty darn quickly because carbs are fast digesting, right? For the most part. When my body digests those carbs, what's going to happen? My blood sugars are going to rise. When my blood sugars go up, I then get a signal to the pancreas, hey, your blood sugars are high. And so what does the pancreas do? The pancreas dumps a bunch of insulin into the bloodstream. Now think of insulin. I like to think of insulin as the key to the cell, essentially. So it's going to come and it's going to basically unlock the cell, allow it to pull those blood sugars into the cell, reducing blood sugar levels, right? But also, when we get a big surge of insulin, we're also going to get a release of leptin. Now, leptin's going to be one of our best fat-burning aspects, but it's also going to give us kind of that fullness cue, right? And say, hey, we're good. And so if we get in a position that we constantly cut carbs out altogether, we're not going to get this insulin response that helps shuttle nutrients into the cell more effectively. Now, the other problem is if we're in a position that we completely cut carbs out, carbs allow that sense of oh, everything's going to be okay. This is why we get the feelings of euphoria. And let's say we're super stressed out. We're running on all cylinders. Your body's starting to feel like it's going to crack. We're at that point of cracking. And you go and you eat a meal that has some carbohydrates in it. And instantly, all of a sudden, you feel, oh, man, I'm okay. Everything's going to be okay. And it's because your blood sugars start to stabilize. The body loves homeostasis. And so if you're a very high-functioning, high-paced individual, and you've always incorporated carbs in your life, and then you completely cut carbs out, you're going to feel like garbage because your body's scrambling for that nutrient source to keep you fueled. And again, if the carbs aren't present, it's going to find it one way or another, and that's going to come from either your protein or muscle breakdown. And so carbs are, you know, a lot of people say there's not a single essential carbohydrate. And it's true. There are essential amino acids and there are essential fatty acids, but there are no essential carbohydrates. But there's context behind that always. Let's say if I have a female that's very high performing, she loves to do CrossFit. That's her performed method of exercise. Well, we know that that method of exercise is very quick pace. And we know that fats are not a fast-paced fuel source. They're a much slower burning energy source. So if I'm going to have a client that's very high pace in her work life and very high pace in her exercise choice, well, then I'm going to feed her carbs because that style of stimulus requires a lot of glycogen to fuel it. And if I don't give those carbs and you still run on that high pace environment, your body's going to eventually start to break down muscle tissue. And that then causes the cascade throughout the whole body. And again, the high stress there, you're going to cause downregulate. Well, you're going to cause adrenal gland dysfunction. You're going to cause thyroid dysfunction. And then you're going to start to see your sex hormones deplete as well. And so it's just this snowball effect. Now, if I have a client that loves the CrossFit style, loves the high pace environment, I'm going to feed them carbs during that period of time. But then I'm going to have this is the beauty of different exercise stimuluses and being able to pull yourself through. Okay, we go through a period of high stress, intense exercise. Then I'm going to pull you way down here and go more into that AMPK pathway, but adapt your workouts to match the stimulus of the surrounding environment, right?
Gotcha. So more like parasympathetic type training or like walking, yoga, that type of stuff sort of paired with the other higher stress days.
Certainly. Certainly. So we might go through, we might go through a 6-week period of really pushing the body for muscle growth and really pushing that stimulus. And then we might spend the next 6 to 8 weeks of going into more of a like you said, a parasympathetic type stimulus. We could still include some weight training 2 to 3 days a week, but we might go to a full body type stimulus or a half body split, and definitely not pushing anything to failure at that point if the goal is to let the body recover, gotcha. Right? And so we have to always take the goal into consideration as well with that.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And so you mentioned the flexibility between switching from carbs as a fuel source to fats and vice versa. One thing that came to mind there, are you a fan of carb cycling then per se? So like for instance, for high carb days, 3 low carb days, etc. within a week, or really do you prefer, as you mentioned, just then like an actual block of like 6 to 8 weeks of something and then switching 6 to 8 weeks of something different?
Yeah, so I like that question. I think a lot of it is the overall goal. If I have someone that's in a very diseased, inflamed state, I'm going to go through different, time frames. So for example, to get an adaptation of the ketogenic diet, I'm probably going to have to sit someone in that for 6 to 8 weeks straight without any refeeds, to actually get them keto adapted, where their body says, oh, I have no carbs present. I've understood the assignment of how to run off of ketones. And so I might sit them in that block for 6 to 8 weeks, get that adaptation, and then slowly walk them back in and introduce carbs again, right? But very slowly. But from the other perspective, let's say I have someone that's gearing up and we're going to go through a fat loss phase and we decide, okay, we're going to use a carb cycling technique. Well, what do we know when we put someone into a caloric deficit? We know eventually the body's going to adapt to the caloric intake that we load, right? And so if the body's going to adapt, well, we know that lower calories is going to reduce in lower hormones. We're going to see the thyroid downregulate, right? Your T3 is going to be lower. And we know that T3 levels, 3.2 is considered optimal. And we know that when the thyroid starts to downregulate, your fat burning capabilities are going to slow down. And so I like carb cycling in this sense, because if I pull carbs down quite a bit, your body should start to use fats more of a fuel source when the carbs are not present, right? Again, metabolic flexibility. We run into the issue when people get carbs low and their body can't burn the fats, right? So assuming metabolic flexibility is there, we pull down carbs, your body says, oh, in the time carbs aren't present, I'm going to burn through this fat that I have as an extra energy source. But eventually your body, like I said, is going to downregulate. And so then, yeah, I could throw in a 3 or 4 day refeed with higher carb intake in the mix. And you're going to, if the metabolism is working effectively, and you can test this on your clients, you can test this on yourself. If you go, you know, a period of lower carbs, and then we go a 3 to 4 day refeed when the body is showing signs of, okay, things are starting to slow down, energy slowing down, mood slowing down, your energy in the gym isn't as good, you're losing strength. We might give a 3 to 4 day refeed. Your energy is going to shoot through the roof. Your body temperature is going to crank up significantly, because we're going to see that thyroid crank back up because we just gave it the fuel that it needs to ramp up and really get rolling. And so when we do that, now the thyroid kicks back up, your body's internal temperature is heated back up, which means, hey, we're going to burn things more effectively. So by doing a carb cycle, it can be very effective at, okay, we go through a deficit, you know, we see this fat loss come down. Okay, things start to downregulate. We jump food up and then boom, body cranks back up. And now we're back up at baseline, and then we can drop back into a deficit and keep that fat burning rolling. So yes, there's a time and place for every diet modality. I think every single fad diet out there, I personally think there's a time and place for it. I'm not selective to any one diet, because every single diet has benefits to it. It's just application. And, you know, can the client also handle it from a psychological standpoint?
Right, absolutely. And that's probably one of the main challenges. And it's funny how some of these diets come from a clinical perspective or clinical setting, more like the keto diet being used for more like epilepsy or whatever. And then we just apply it to normal life and think we can sustain and maintain that for the years to come. And people realize, oh, wow, no, actually, that doesn't work for me long term. That's a small, but very, very, very important detail that many people miss when they think about trying all these various diets. But one thing that also really stands out to me when I look at your Instagram, and everyone who's listening, go and check out Dane's Instagram, because so much valuable information on there. And you really do also emphasize the importance of high quality fiber when it comes to carbs, because carbs are not, you know, not all carbs are equal, not all calories are equal. And so sometimes people hear, oh, high carbs or a higher carb approach, and they're either super afraid or they just think of like bread and rice and whatever. But, you know, I think if I'm not mistaken, you do try to get people to eat like 30, 40 grams of fiber a day, if not more, depending on someone's size. And I think that's really an important part that's often missed when we talk about carbs.
Yeah. Fiber is crucial, right? So, I mean, we look at high fiber carb sources. I mean, the ones that I really like to utilize, I do like gluten-free oatmeal. I like sweet potatoes. I like all my berries. You know, I like my bananas. I like my apples. Fruits are incredible in the right setting, right? You know, fiber. So what does fiber do? So fiber, for one, it is going to help keep your cholesterol in a good spot, right? It's going to help kind of sweep up some of the bad cholesterol, but it's also going to help repair the mucosa lining and keep the mucosa lining of the digestive tract intact. So the mucosa lining of the digestive tract, think of this as like the base floor of the digestive tract, which should be a tightly knit conjunction of cells, right? That keep this membrane so it's non-permeable, right? So things can't seep through it. When we go to our typical American diet, we have basically no fiber. We have high inflammatory food sources. And then you match that with your high stress lifestyle, no sleep, you know, soda, all these variables that cause inflammation in the gut. Well, we know that there's a feedback loop here, that when cortisol, being your quote unquote stress hormone, cortisol goes up, that causes damage to the mucosa lining and the digestive tract. And then the damage to the mucosa lining causes more cortisol to be released from the body because it's a stressor. So we get into this endless cycle. And over time, what happens is this tightly knit junction of cell membranes eventually starts to develop gaps in it, right? Gaps and cracks within it. So now we can see, okay, well, now this membrane is permeable. So we eat our foods, and this is perfect from like an immune system standpoint, right? And especially we see this more active in females because females make up 70% of autoimmunities. But let's say you have someone that's never been reactive to gluten or dairy, never had an issue in their entire life. And now as they're eating gluten, they start to get bloated, they start to feel gross, and they're wondering, what is going on? Why? I've eaten this my entire life, and now I feel like garbage from it. Well, these high levels of cortisol and inflammatory foods have caused the damage to the mucosa lining. And now little particles of this food seep through that mucosa lining into the bloodstream. And now your immune system says, hey, high alert, what's going on there? And so it's your immune system that's causing the symptoms, right? It's not necessarily the foods, it's the immune's response to the food sources now. And over time, you having underlying digestive issues and imbalance in this mucosa lining will develop autoimmune disorders because your immune system gets an overdrive every single time you eat. It flares up and says, hey, whatever that is, we need to attack that and get it out of the system. And so the more damage you cause to the mucosa lining, the more immune activity is going to be present. And you'll see it. Anyone you ask that has any sort of autoimmune disorder, they started out with no food sensitivities, and then one started to pop up. And then soon enough, another, and then another, and then another. And then they're down to literally eating low FODMAP, just basic food sources, and they're still having a reaction, right? And a lot of this starts from the high stress and this damage to the mucosa lining. So when I talk about fiber is huge for keeping that mucosa lining intact and also keeping the balance of good to bad bacteria in the gut balanced out, because that's another big issue. Not only the mucosa lining, but your balance of healthy bacteria in the gut is going to determine whether or not you absorb your food properly. You know, that's also going to play a big role in your skin quality, not to mention 70% of your serotonin receptors are found in your gut, which serotonin makes you feel good, makes you feel at peace. And so, you know, a lot of these people go to, you know, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, where the root cause is more than likely what they're eating in their gut health. And so we encourage higher fiber intake to help coat that mucosa lining, keep the balance of bacteria more in line, and keep a strong, you know, mucosa membrane in that digestive tract.
Super, super interesting. And I think an added benefit also to fiber or higher fiber diets is always just the satiation. Like if you match carbs and you have a diet that's like 5 or 10 grams of fiber and another one that's 40, it's going to make a world of difference, particularly if someone is trying to lose weight. So yeah, I love that. I do have a question in regards to hormones, because we talked about that a couple of times now, or you brought it up in the sense of stress hormones and just other hormone fluctuations. But before I ask that question, just one more thing. When it comes to the gut lining that you mentioned there, are you a fan of using glutamine as a form to help support that gut lining? Or to your knowledge, is there not actually that much evidence supporting the supplementation of glutamine for that purpose?
Yeah, no. So L-glutamine, I love L-glutamine. There are a few specific variables that I don't like it. And I would have to double check, but I want to say if you have the gene snippet, a double blockage on your GAD1 gene. Now I may be mistaken on that. But some of those people can't break down glutamate properly, and it can lead to further issues. Now, I might have that gene snippet wrong, but that's something to look into. But for general population, I love, love, love glutamine. Because as you cause damage to that digestive tract and that mucosa lining, and let's say it's almost like your body's fighting an ongoing infection. And if that's been going on for long enough, you have what's called your secretory IgA, which is essentially the immune system of the gut. We're going to initially see that crank up really high. And then once your body's been fighting that infection for a long period of time, it's going to eventually go low because your immune system says, hey, we're tired of fighting this battle. And so that glutamine is one of the best ways to actually get that secretory Ig back up and regulated. And so the way I prefer glutamine is 10 grams morning, 10 grams evening, for probably 3 to 4 months. Now, it's also very soothing to the gut lining as well. So if people have, you know, history of stomach ulcers or an ongoing ulcer, I really like glutamine in the mix as well. And then I did want to touch one other thing on fiber for any of you that are listening to this and realizing, wow, I'm getting about 7 grams of fiber in my diet a day. Lisa and Dane just said I should be getting 40. Absolutely do not take your 7 grams and go up to 40 overnight. You're going to wreck your stomach. You're going to be in pain. I would recommend walking it up 5 to 7 grams every 4 to 5 days and slowly titrate that up. So take that at a slow pace.
That's a really good reminder. I also experimented with the vegan diet. At some point, I just wanted to prove I can hit my protein even on a vegan diet, blah, blah. And yeah, I did exactly what you just mentioned. Maybe not going from 7, but like from 20 to like 45 or 50. And I was constipated and I was in in a lot of pain for several days. So nowadays I know better and I do recommend to my clients to slowly taper it up. But yes, in regards to hormones, so you mentioned that of course we all live very high stress lives, or most of us do. We many of the people listening here will be more on the side of like overtraining. You mentioned like CrossFit, high intensity type of work, etc. Also on top of a busy life. So often when they get to perimenopause or menopause, that's when really the hormonal issues start showing up, because we have all the other hormones too, like testosterone, estrogens, etc. That then get into a bit of a let's just call it whirlwind, and the high stress isn't helping with that. So what, on top of diet things and making sure that we're not cutting carbs too low, etc., can people do in order to support their hormonal health, particularly throughout the time of perimenopause and menopause?
Yeah. So when it comes down to that hormonal support, I mean, for one, we know that as you start to get into that perimenopause and go through menopause, what happens? The ovaries start to shut down production of your estrogen and your progesterone and your main sex hormones in the female body, right? And so when that starts to happen, your adrenal glands definitely make up a part of your hormonal regulation and hormone creation. And so we know if we apply too much stress, those adrenal glands are going to shut down. And so there goes a piece of the puzzle right there. But then on top of that, we also know that dietary cholesterol, we know that your cholesterol will branch down and trickle down into hormones as well. And so the best way to look at it, where you're going through perimenopause and menopause, first thing, before you even get there, try to build as much muscle tissue as you can leading into that phase. Because once you go through that stage, your rate of muscle growth is going to slow down drastically. And we really want to support, because we know that muscle tissue is going to fuel that metabolism even further. And so that's a big kicker. But then when it comes to overall hormonal support and the way that I like to approach it, because when you go through menopause as well, not only do hormones change, but your entire microbiome of the gut is going to change as well. So that good and bad bacterial balance that we discussed, that's going to take a major change as you go through that menopausal process as well. And we know if your digestive health isn't well, we also know that we excrete hormones through our digestive tract. And so we've got to make sure digestion's on point, especially phase one, phase two, and phase three detoxification pathways. So what I mean by that is we detoxify our estrogen mainly through our pee and poo. And if we're in a position, phase one and phase two detoxification pathways happen in the liver, and phase three happen in the digestive tract. So if your body's trying to excrete estrogen out of the body down a healthy manner, and you're having bowel movements once every 3 or 4 days, that's a big red flag, because you're going to basically release that estrogen back into the body. And if you have poor detoxification pathways, this is what can lead to estrogen-based cancers. A lot of people, you know, let's say when they get on hormone replacement therapy as they go through menopause, they end up developing cancer, and they say the culprit is the estrogen. I don't believe that. And studying under Dr. Carrie Jones, who is a savant, she's incredible, she makes it very, very clear that it's the detox pathways. And if we have our detoxification pathways clear, the chances of developing that estrogen-based cancers are very, very minimal. So that's something to be considerate of, is digestive health is crucial through your entire life, but very crucial, you know, through menopause as well. But I would say the best way to support hormones throughout this process is going to a Mediterranean-based diet, pulling your workouts down to 2 to 3 days of a full body exercise, maybe some Pilates mixed in the mix, and then a lot of parasympathetic activity. So lots of walking, lots of yoga, really dialing in your cortisol, your circadian rhythm, with waking up, getting morning sunlight exposure, getting proper hydration first thing in the morning, going for a walk in the morning, right? And then making sure as the day winds down that you're not exposing yourself to excessive amounts of blue light. So I like to wear 99% blue light blocking glasses. They have to be orange lens. You're going to wear those for about the last hour and a half before bed. And when you put these on, you're going to notice your body just come down 10 notches. You're going to get a better night's rest. So I think the best thing you can do is Mediterranean diet, circadian rhythm. Stop doing your high intense workouts and go to 2 to 3 days of full body and parasympathetic activity. And then also getting with a doctor that really understands hormones, because I'm a big advocate of hormone replacement therapy as well. Now, estrogen, a lot of doctors won't prescribe estrogen because of the fear of estrogen-based cancers. But one thing you need to remember is estrogen is very crucial for heart health. It's also very, very crucial for bone strength and bone integrity. So this is why we see females that have no muscle tissue go into menopause. Their estrogen completely shuts down. They don't get on any sort of hormone replacement therapy. Their diet stays in a bad position. And at 65 years old, they fall down, they break a hip, and that they're done. Because they have no muscle tissue to support. And then their bones are brittle and weak because that estrogen's been out of their system for 15 years now. And so having someone that can understand and prescribe these hormones in the proper setting, give you proper guidance, I think is absolutely crucial as you go through the menopausal.
Yeah, it's really a shame what sort of almost damaged that study by the World Health Initiative did. I don't know exactly what year it came out, but where it was basically linking hormone therapy or estrogen therapy to cancer. And that was just completely falsely portrayed because, we don't need to get into the details of this study, but I'm glad that more and more people are talking about and discovering and researching and showing that the right hormone therapy at the right time, so not post-menopause, but pre-menopause or perimenopause rather, is certainly effective, and that it doesn't always have to be just estrogen, but we can start with, you know, progesterone or testosterone just to get the woman feeling better also. So yeah, I like that you're touching on that importance of that as well.
And if I can, Lisa, I want to touch thing there. So just kind of full circle, you know, we kind of talked about fasting and now we're kind of in the menopausal state, right? So if we have someone that has been chronically inflamed their whole life, right? And we go through menopause and we haven't fixed the chronic inflammation, right? Just inflammation throughout the body, inflammation at the cell site. And you go through menopause and you hear all these good things about hormone replacement therapy. And you say, you know what? Okay, I found a doctor. They're going to get me rolling on hormone replacement therapy. And let's say you get on it and you feel no difference, right? Because we see it. And females are like, they draw the conclusion, well, shit, that didn't do anything good for me. I was just taking extra stuff each day. Well, I don't think that it's the hormones not working. I think it's you have so much inflammation at the receptor sites for those hormones that the cells can't even communicate with what's coming in the body. And so that's another big thing that we need to understand is if you have so many of these disease senescent cells that have built up year over year over year over year, and then you go to use hormones and you feel no difference, that's a big red flag that, hey, there's still so much inflammation at the cell site that your hormones can't even communicate properly, which I would highly recommend. And I have majority of my clients, we are testing fasted blood sugars and we're testing postprandial blood sugars 2.5 hours after a meal, because that tells us a lot about not only insulin resistance and how well your insulin is able to shuttle nutrients into the cell, but it also tells us how much just chronic inflammation is at that cellular site to determine, okay, well, can your body actually communicate properly, or is everything blocked off because there's so much inflammation in the body? That's why when I get majority of females that come to me that feel like crap, they can't sleep, they can't lose weight, the first thing we do, we pull exercise out of the mix. We focus on the parasympathetic activity. We go to a low inflammatory diet. We get their sleep dialed in, we manage their stress, and more often than not, you see 5 to 10 pounds drop within the first 3 months. And they're like, how did this even happen? And it's all because we reduced the inflammation and got the body connecting. There are 11 systems in the body. All of them feed into one another. If one's causing a roadblock, all the others aren't going to work properly. So I just wanted to touch on that piece as well.
No, that's such a good point. I was actually thinking about that this morning because I just shared with you before we started recording that I went away over the weekend and I basically had 3 rest days in a row. And I normally don't take 3 rest days from training in a row. And so I stepped on the scale this morning and it was down like a kilo, so like 2.5 pounds almost. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I don't really see that number normally. That's like unusually low for me. Not that that's something that I'm striving for at all. It was just interesting, but I have heard that and seen that many a times from other clients as well that come back after a vacation and they actually think, oh no, if I'm stepping on the scale, it's going to be higher. And then often it's actually lower because they're forced to do nothing. And you know, they might have gone for beach walks, but that's about it.
So what does that tell you, Lisa, when you see a client see that response where they've taken extra time off of training? What does that tell you? Why does the scale drop in that scenario?
Well, yeah, I definitely think that, as you said, like through a drop of that overall cortisol load, they're dropping, or their inflammation is reducing throughout that time. They're relaxing, so their mind is forced to calm down, to switch into the parasympathetic. They're usually probably overtraining, or at least non-functionally overreaching, perhaps. So, you know, it's a good sign, or it's a sign for both of us, for me and for the client, that, hey, perhaps we're doing a bit too much, actually. Overall, we would probably benefit from pulling back.
and also, when we see 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 pounds, even sometimes, in scale fluctuations from one day to another, you know, clients start to freak out. Right. And, you know, one of the biggest things you need to understand is that when cortisol goes up, again, cortisol being our stress hormone, we also see an increase in aldosterone, which aldosterone holds on to water retention. And so if we're overstressing the body, that aldosterone is going to go up, cause more water retention. And so you're going to see that scale increase 3, 4, 5 pounds. And a lot of clients will freak out. Well, you got to recognize from one day to the next, you physically can't put on that much muscle tissue. And you physically can't lose that much fat. So the variable is water. And when you take the stress out of the mix, that cortisol drops, that aldosterone drops, you flush out more water, and then you see a 2 to 3 pound drop because the cortisol has dropped. So the scale can be a deceiving, deceiving tool, although it's a good tool to understand if mentally you can adapt to it and what it tells us. But it can also be, you know, the downfall for a lot of clients as well.
For sure. But I do think that, especially for that reason, it's actually good to weigh in more frequently than not often, because sometimes people are like, oh, I don't like stepping on the scale. I'm just going to step on there once a month or once a week. And then they put so much pressure on that one weight. And like you said, the day before, it could be 2 pounds higher. The day after, it could be 2 pounds lower. So at least if we are stepping on there regularly, I feel like it's almost taking away the emotional load more, and you learn to just see it as data than if you don't weigh as frequently.
And it's all in the language with the client. You have to educate the client. If you have the client doing something and they can't wrap their head around the why behind what they're doing, they're never going to be able to sustain it. And so I've seen you instill it in your coaching. I mean, me and my team at Maximum Performance Health, that's one of the biggest things I harp on, is I want to educate the client the why behind everything we're doing, so they can adapt an understanding. Because I don't, yeah, would it be awesome to have a client with me for 25 years? I mean, maybe. But eventually I want it to be to the point where they feel the confidence of, hey, I understand what I'm doing. You've taught me all the tools. I understand nutrition. I understand how to fuel and recover properly. And eventually they graduate, right? And do things on their own. That's the ultimate goal in coaching.
I love that. And yeah, thank you, Dane, so much for your time. I want to respect your time. I only got like halfway through the list of questions I was going to ask you, but maybe that just means you'll have to come back on in a couple of months. So thank you so much.
You are so welcome. I apologize. I ramble a lot.
No,
so.
I love it. I would say you go into the detail, and that's exactly what we like to hear. So yes, thank you. And maybe you want to shout out your social media, or I will obviously drop some handles in the show notes here as well, but where can people find you?
Yep. So on Instagram, Fitness Dane, Fitness Dane is my Instagram handle. Listen, I am what I am on there. I'm my own personality. You're going to get some good things, and you're going to get some things that you're like, man, what, this Dane guy's something. So
authenticity, that's what we love. So again, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Lisa. Have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share the episode on social. Very much appreciated. You can also follow us on Instagram at Nutrition Coaching and Life, or head to our website, www.nutritioncoachingandlife.com, where we provide more valuable content. Have a wonderful day. Now go out and work on your best self.